This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by The Shared World. Epic tales of swords and sorcery available at sharedworld.ca.
Attention, citizens. It's time for Super Pulp Science.
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how a genre gets made. I'm GMB Kamichak, a working writer and illustrator. I'm here with my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry. He's known the world over as Chasing Artwork, and in Brandon as Kind of a Big Deal. I'm also pleased to announce a temporary replacement of Dan Vetterbunker as our...
You're happy to announce that?
Well, just so that Dan will be upset that I said that.
Yeah, I would never replace Dan. And in fact, I've sat in this chair a number of times already and made
it.
Mistakes. Yeah.
Dear listener, you should know that Justin and I have tried to record podcasts ourselves properly. And some of them you've been forced to listen to, and they've had many, let's say, inconsistencies in the recording quality. Those are usually Justin and my fault. And so... Dan, our producer, was clear to say he couldn't make it today to record, but he said, as long as Lyndon is there to supervise, you're permitted to record this episode. So that is, you all caught up, dear listener, as to what is going on here today. So who to blame is Lyndon if it all goes wrong?
As always.
As always.
That's actually the studio motto most of the time.
Because
if someone makes a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's, yeah, Lyndon didn't do it.
If it goes well, it's something that Sam Biko set up years ago. And if it goes badly, it's Lyndon dropping it, right?
That's right, yeah.
So it's perfect. So.
Speaking of going well.
Yeah.
I think we should start off talking about Brandon, because you brought it up in the intro.
Yeah.
Gregor and I just got back from, not the very first...
So they switched venues. So it's called the Westman Gaming Expo.
Right.
And it's the first time they did it at the Keystone Center. Continue.
Right. So it's the first time they went from a smaller event to like a full event center. And they had a huge room full of vendors and collectors tables and a full-on night demonstrations, people in armor.
Wait, hold that. That's a,
okay.
We're going to bury that lead.
And then another adjacent hall that was just packed. With like, I don't know, like 50 tables all in full Warhammer games or like equivalent like miniature like tabletop gaming. Those guys were in there from like 10 in the morning till 8 at night.
Yeah, they're
both
playing
3-hour
matches. Now, I'm not a big Warhammer guy, so I don't know how it all works. I just know, as a gaming guy, the look of pure satisfaction when a room full of people who you don't have to explain why you're interested in something are all there with you. And that room was full of that. Like they were just so comfortable to be in each other's presence. It was really great.
I was like, as a vendor, I saw that room and I was really, really excited. But we didn't, like, they did come over to our room every once in a while.
Every 3 hours.
Yeah. Every 3 hours, a match would be over. But they were like, they were all not at the same time. So we'd get them in a trickle.
Yeah.
But it was kind of weird having a room so full of people nearby that were not coming over to your side, you know?
Yeah, that is true. So for those of you who are maybe listening for the very first time, maybe because you found us at the Brandon Show, what we usually talk about on this transmission is how we write stuff, how we make stuff, how we produce it, how we publish it, how we get it into stores, how we take it out there on our own. All the vagaries. And so one of the ways in which we distribute directly is we find events where our demographic overlaps with the people of those events, and we try to bring our stuff direct to them so that the distributor is not in the way and the publisher is not in the way, and we can get firsthand acknowledgement of, is this right or wrong? You know, it'd be another thing to send somebody else and you see the sales report, but you actually don't know how people felt about anything. And so it can be really,
it's also like life affirming. Like it does good for your soul to see people enjoy that book that you put months of your life into, and it connects.
And then the other piece of it is during the event, as we call it around the studio, during the lockdown, I had made a list of places that were closer to Winnipeg than all the other distant cities that we go to, that there's no reason why we don't make the effort to go visit. And Brandon was on my list. And because Brandon also is the home of a producer and director of The Princess and the Dragon, the independent horror film I'm working on, it was a perfect way to try a convention, visit with them, do like a work meeting so that if one thing didn't go well, it was fine. It was worth the risk. But man, what would you have to say about the Westman Gaming Expo?
Yeah, it was like similar for me. I like trying local events are always better, right? When you don't have to worry about when travel isn't something you have to stress out about, when your hotel isn't something you have to stress out about, like already better show. But you also kind of can go to too many events locally, right? Like after your second, third event in so many months, like people have seen you already or whatever. Right. So it's good to travel and try some things. And Brandon is about a 2.5 hour drive away, and they don't have a lot of events. Like we keep our eye out for events like this, and there just hasn't been that many. So it was a great opportunity just to like reach a new crowd, and quite a few of the people that we met like do come to Winnipeg for the conventions here. So there is like some overlap there, but there was a lot of conversations of people just excited that an event like this was happening, and they've been waiting for something like this, and so that kind of got the wheels turning on us maybe doing something of our own in some other like smaller towns. And I've noticed this with school visits as well. I'll do like a lot of school visits like out at small rural communities, and like the amount of books that I move at some of these like towns that are like under 1,000 people is like, oh, that's...
And not an insignificant amount, yeah. And it's because I think why I think it works is not because you're the traveling snake oil salesman that's like, ah, this book cures everything, you know, fix your arthritis, get your hair back, buy my book. Instead, most people think of small towns as places you leave if you want to do creative work. That's kind of the unfortunate cliche, is that people are from small towns if they've done that work.
You got to go to New York or LA.
That's right.
Well, aren't you two both examples of that?
Well, I didn't grow up in a small town per se, but I grew up outside of Winnipeg. Well,
come on. We're in Winnipeg. We're in a small town.
Yeah, we're in... But what I'm trying to get at here is when we go there and we remind them that the technology we use to do these things, you can do from anywhere.
Well, yeah. Any like, so say you have a client in Winnipeg local and you have a client in LA.
Yeah.
What is the difference between your, like you are still just emailing them, you're still sending your work digitally, and then it's still like there is no difference between those two clients.
Yeah, absolutely.
Communication wise.
And so when we show up in a small town, they see us doing the work and we're like them because we, you know, you're from Pilot Mound and I grew up in St. Germain. And so we're not there saying, oh, you have to be from somewhere important in order to have done work. You just have to do work. It's like, are you a creative kid? Yeah, so keep doodling, man. Just keep at it.
And that was something that came up at the school visits. I was asked at two different schools, like, so, like, do you feel like you're not getting as many opportunities because you don't live in Toronto or because you don't live in, like,
absolutely
a bigger
not.
City?
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's what I said. Like, our coworkers, because we travel around to conventions all over the place, like, our coworkers, I'm doing air quotes, are from Calgary and Toronto and L.A., and we've got one from Vancouver and New York. And we are not getting any less opportunities or big clients than they are. Like, the client load is very similar because location really doesn't have much to do with artists.
But our cost of living is so much less.
Yeah, as we say from our big studio in downtown, which this would not be a thing if we were in any other city.
Yeah,
and,
Toronto,
well, and then at the end of the day, we go home to our houses
that we
own.
Yeah,
yeah, and you know that's not a flex. That is that's we live in a city where housing is inexpensive compared to everywhere else in Canada.
And we got 6 inches of snow last night.
Yeah. So you can.
I kind of like that part.
Take the good with the bad, but I like the snow too. Yeah. I was thrilled, honestly. Yeah.
Where will you find this miracle?
I have heard there is a tree at the end of the world, with a fleece of gold hanging in its branches.
I've heard it put many different ways, but I think the one I like the best is that it's not what you make, it's what you keep. And one of the ways that you can keep more is pick a more inexpensive place to live. Hmm. And as technology bridges the gap between who the clients are and where they are, where we game that system is we get on a plane and we physically visit the cities where those clients are, and you can meet them there and then go home and do the work. So there is, it's not as easy as it sounds, like you can just email people and get those clients. You do have to put in the legwork, at least in our generation.
But you don't have to live there.
Yeah, you don't have to live there. Yeah. No. You absolutely do not.
That's
have to live there.
Never part of the conversation when you're talking with like a potential new client.
Yeah, where do you live?
Right? Like
on
nobody cares. Yeah. Doesn't matter anymore.
And if they do care, that's a red flag.
Right.
Yeah. So thank you, Brandon. It was a great show. And the very motivated, very small attendance, but they didn't promise a big attendance. When I got in touch with the organizers, they said, oh, it might be up to 600 people. This is the kind of stuff they're into. This is what we've done in the past. And then, let me tell you, dear listener, my favorite part about the show. Justin chose wrong, which is always makes me happy. He got there before me because I was staying for my son's birthday party. And so I drove out late. Justin had been there early, and he picked a nice spot. We had a big area, and he set up.
We didn't
his
have
booth.
Spots. They gave us like a huge, like a 40 by 40 square of the floor and a pile of tables and said, go to town.
Yeah, do what you want. So Justin set up his booth, pointed at that busy room. And my booth was set up on the opposite side of him, at this pointed at this weird corral area. But the corral was, in fact, the site of hourly combat between armored knights doing full contact sword play exercises. I could not have been having more fun. I kept popping over to Justin's booth, be like, come and look, they're shooting arrows at him now. Oh, look, they're hitting him in the head with an axe. Quick, quick, get over here. So I had the absolute best time. And I think if there's one note, anyone maybe from that show who's listening, advertise that that happens at the show.
That was definitely one of the main events.
Crowd favorite.
Yeah.
It was, nobody really knew it was happening until they got in there.
Right.
And these giant armor.
And then you
knights,
just hear it. Like, what is going on over there?
And when I say that, like armor, I don't mean like
cosplay armor.
Cosplay. And I don't mean like those jousting guys at the dinner. What is that? Those Knights of the Dinner Table thing where you go and you watch the
medieval
feast
fair.
And the medieval fair. Not like that, because that's more like wrestling.
Right.
These were guys and girls in full heavyweight plate steel armor.
Like historically accurate, I want to say?
Historically, I would say close.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, I'm sure it's lighter metal.
And they were hitting. I thought I'd witnessed a murder more than once.
They were not going easy on each other.
A full weight, like pole arm axe swung from the hip into the head of the other knight, knocked them flat on the ground. And I'm thinking the ambulance is the next thing that is going to arrive at this convention. No. And they would just get up and shake it off because they're wearing appropriate armor for
still
the
still gonna ring your bell.
Yeah,
yeah,
ring,
it
literally.
Was...
I was amazed. And so thank you, armored knights. I don't know, they didn't have a dear knights, get a banner. I don't know what
right.
to call you or how to shout you out.
Yeah. They needed some kind of social media or
yeah
logo.
Just a name.
Name. Yeah.
Just a name. They
a
had
crest.
A, they had
maybe
a,
not a crest.
No,
you would know the name.
Yeah, wouldn't know the name. They had
I'm
some
Google
kind
the
of
crest.
But the crest, like with letter with the name in it, right?
Yes,
in Latin.
I don't know.
In Latin, that would I would have been down with that. So, dear organizers, please put them on your poster because I can't wait to go next year. So yeah, we definitely fully endorse if you're a Winnipeg creator listening to the show and you're looking for a place to go.
And I'm always like the first person to recommend for like creative starting out, like try as many things as you can,
you
right? Like try craft sales, try anime shows, try gaming shows, try Comic Cons, like because some of those one day events are gonna suck. It's gonna happen. Like throughout our career, we have many examples of one day shows being a complete letdown.
Yeah.
And we also have an equally amount of examples of one day shows being way beyond expectations.
So if you take it in the aggregate, you end up with this great, if you do 10 and half of them are kind of stinkers, but half of them are way beyond expectation over the course of the year, you've done great and you've shown up in the community, which is also a huge bonus.
So even when it is a stinker, as Gregory says, you are still getting on, you're advertising, you're getting on the radar. Like if you were to buy an ad to get your artwork seen by that many people in person, right, which is a much more tangible ad than just on the screen, I think very much worth it. And I also find too, when it is a bad show and it's not my fault, there's still something in me that's like deeply disappointed. And that's when the like, what can I do to improve monster rears up? Like, maybe if you had, you know, another book on the table, maybe you had prints like this, maybe if you tried that, maybe you tried that, like the project list that spawns from that is almost something I look forward to. Like, oh, this is going to suck, but by the end of the weekend, I'm going to have a bunch of new ideas.
Because we were back to back, I didn't get to see the interactions of your customers or my customers or your supporters or mine. So I have a question, because this is something I observed in this crowd. Since we go to so many shows, Comic-Con shows, and so many of those people are regulars, I take for granted that they understand how the portfolio works if it's on the table. And I had to explain to the vast majority of people that you can flip through that. There's different work than just the double page spread.
I think maybe like on Gregory's table, dear listener, there are, it's almost like an entire assembly line of portfolios. You have like seven portfolios back to back to back. So it almost looks like it is display.
Yeah, it's
just
okay,
the way mine are a little more like isolated.
Yeah, yours more scarce, so that must be what it's for.
But
yeah,
here's the thing, like my my like hello is, hey, there's more book it more art in the book if you want to take a look. And I kind of flip it for them. So that's kind of my intro to the thing. Like, hey, how's it going? There's more art in here if you want to take a look.
So interesting, because back in the day, I used to do that all the time. And then I kind of got out of the habit of explaining how it worked. And people kind of knew, you know, just because of the size of the show and there's so many repeats. So
you're the 100th booth they've seen.
That's right. So being here where we were sort of the only booth setup that was like that, explaining to people, oh, you can, please feel free to flip through it. Please feel free. You can touch everything. You can, it's not for display. This is for your, you know, for your amusement, essentially.
One big difference at our booth is you load your portfolios backwards so that people can pull out their own posters, right? They'll flip through, like, oh, I really like this Carmilla. Did you know that Carmilla predates Dracula?
I will.
Amazing. Coming so back. I'm going to grab one of those. So the customer pulls the poster out of the portfolio themselves.
Yeah.
And then they go and they gather another one and then they kind of bring it to you and you doodle on it, you bag it up. On mine, I just have one piece in the portfolio page. So Gregory has like five Carmillas in there. I only have one poster per page. And so, especially at this show, I noticed when people had bought from you first, because they thought they knew how this works. So they'd come over to my table and go, oh, I want this one, and try to get it out. And I, no. That's my display one.
I'm leaving that there. That's right. Oh, good. I'm glad I caused trouble for you.
That and then I have a box behind my table of everything kind of stacked vertically so you can flip through quickly. And there's 20 of this one and five of that one.
And well, and in the interest of full disclosure, I think is important reason for that is I have a number of different kinds of themes in my print portfolios. Mm-hmm. Yours are a little bit more focused and your average returning customers are higher and the interest is higher. And so I have kind of a more of a shotgun effect and you're more of a laser.
What you've done is,
right?
Like say if like just for easy math, I'd say like, you know, if I have in my entire portfolio 500 pieces and you probably have 750 pieces. Right. Again, we're just simple math here.
Yeah.
You are bringing like probably 250 of those pieces to show. So you can't do my method because one portfolio cannot fill that. So you spread it out of all those portfolios.
And, I've created, it's kind of a hydra of its own making because certain people become regulars of certain bodies of work. If I don't bring it, it hurts me. And if I do bring it, it's harder to have all of it on display.
And what I've done is taken those pieces and I've narrowed it down to the pieces that fit in the portfolio. So around 60 paintings, and then I have some longer pieces. So I probably have 65, 70 paintings at my table versus the 250 at yours. And my kind of pitch is, if you don't see it, it's because I've retired it to make room for the new stuff. That's I'm always making new stuff. And as I make new stuff, the old stuff retires. So every 2-3 years, this booth is different.
Yeah. Because and that's true of mine also. Every 2-3 years, the booth is different. But and the I retire from the portfolios, but it's a broader spread.
Right.
Right. So it's interesting. And every time I add a new interest, I add a new portfolio full of work. So, and my interests keep growing. And so eventually that will.
It's going to become just untenable.
Yeah. So I'll have to narrow it down.
First, search for this golden fleece. Do not reveal yourself to Pelias, but build a ship and find a crew. And when you have this prize, then and only then, return and kill Pelias.
But part of it, too, is the nature of experimentation with how many different media that I'm working in. I find that having a portfolio full of related images prompts the right question. For example, if someone is flipping through the Minus Institute posters and they say, man, I like this. What's this from? There's right. so much of it. It must be from something. But I've never heard of it, you know, and how could you? Because I'm not that big of a deal. I say, yes, it's from my graphic novel, which is here on the table. And so if they liked it, their most cost-effective way to get into it, quote-unquote, is to buy the graphic novel, right? Or buy the graphic novel and a couple of the posters that they liked, and it kind of legitimizes it as a complete right. idea. And so I've been finding that it's a really interesting and fun way to test the market of an idea is to have a short run of the associated material.
And then that could become a book based on
right.
the interest there.
Yeah.
And I kind of do something similar. I have art books, kind of accumulations of all my work put into one book with tutorials and step-by-steps. And a lot of people who are interested in the older pieces that I don't have available at the site anymore.
Oh, that's an easy way to find them. Yeah.
So like I don't have them here, but they're in that book and that has all my old stuff and a bunch of other stuff, and blah, blah, blah.
That's interesting.
All these tricks.
That's interesting.
Are you ever going to bring back the booth of all of the old pieces? Didn't you do that for a couple of years?
Yeah, we did that experiment.
So I tried that out. There's a couple shows on our circuit that are big enough that I found having two booths didn't cannibalize yourself, right? Like people couldn't find you, couldn't find everybody, couldn't see everybody. So having two booths wasn't like a detriment. And so I set up a booth entirely of my older work and then a booth entirely of my newer work. And then I made it kind of a game as well. If you found one booth, you could take that purchase to the other booth and get like a discount on something there. So it was like a reason to visit both. I did like it. It kind of like the stars really have to align with like help and logistics of getting all that stuff there.
Yeah, there's a lot more to manage if you do it. And then also, because remember we were testing that at the Calgary show, the Calgary floor plan became so unreliable to know where and how things would be.
Calgary? Unreliable?
No, I'm not casting shade on the organizers, at least in public. But what I mean is because the convention center was under construction, right? Then they started moving this table over here and that table over there and these areas were over there. And you had to like, it was harder if someone was going to go from the retired stock booth to yours, they had to cross a parking lot and go into a new building, right?
Yeah. And that was back in the day where it was they weren't exactly advertising that it was stretched across two buildings. So it was a lot of people who like, when I said, have you been to that building yet? The response was, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Right? And even like, I remember the first year they did that, I was a vendor in the one building. I was like trying to find the other building. And I asked volunteers like, hey, I want to check out the other building. And they're like, I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know where it is. Like, that was bad. It's gotten a lot better. People have been trained. The organizers have gotten a lot better at like funneling the crowd.
Just wait, once they combine it back into one super building, everyone will be wandering around that other one.
Yeah, like trying to get in. Like,
yeah, wondering what happened.
Yeah.
Okay, so we went to a tiny show. We've just been talking about a huge show. And what I like about it is that our way of operating at either is basically the same.
Well, no, let's talk about that, because like what we just were saying with you, you had how many portfolios of that show?
Oh, I had like, so much. Like so this is what I was going to get at.
11 portfolios.
A way of operating, and this is where the Hydra starts to eat its own body, right? At a small show where it's much easier to get square footage at a reasonable price, having a huge display is cost effective. It's no problem. But having that same scale of display at a big show, suddenly the return has to match. And now you start wondering how many people will show up. What is the average cost? What is the average return per customer? You got all this business stuff in your head. when you're paying 10 times or 20 times the cost for your booth.
Like the really big shows, like it's like, let's like New York and San Diego and Toronto Fan Expo, right? Like shows that like break 100,000 attendees without breaking a sweat.
Yeah.
Those you don't have to worry about as much. It's more like the medium-sized unknown shows, like people doing, like Saskatoon is great for us. We can drive to Saskatoon. We can bring as much as we can carry because we're driving. People coming in from Toronto or you know, Vancouver to Saskatoon, that's something they have to weigh, right? Like how many attendees? What is it going to cost me to stay there? Like there's all those questions. So it's the medium-sized shows that always kind of worry me about.
So if you're new, though, and you're just starting out.
If you're starting out, I would keep it local.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't do Toronto if you're new to it. Keep it local. Look for small shows. The reason that you're talking about it as not being a risk is because we now have, we just use the word setups. We have a setup, which means like the accordion that can fill whatever space we're given.
Mm-hmm.
So if we know that we have two tables, we know what our two table setup is. We've got that on lock. We know exactly how many suitcases that is. We've done it enough to know what to bring. It's not a big stress.
Yeah.
And if you have eight tables or 10, we can accordion it out. You and I could fill a 10-table booth.
But
other people would be stretched to the point where that would be a diminishing return each time. So if you're starting out, just think about it as an accordion. How big can you stretch it before it stops making the music you want?
And I think like, and Lyndon, you kind of just went through this, like that happens naturally, right? You'll start with your one table and you'll kind of struggle to fill it up that first year or two. And then it hits a point where like, I want more. Like one table is not enough and everything's started to get crowded.
Yeah, we did our first year doing shows. We called ourselves One Table Guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kept making things, and we felt that, okay, we're ready to become two table guys.
You guys were really excited about that. I remember the moment. I think it was in Toronto where you're like, we think we're next two table guys.
Yeah, well, and it was because Toronto was our last show as a one table show, because then Winnipeg was the next show, same year. But we had, in the middle of the pandemic, when that show was getting established, they were selling tables for really cheap. And so I, you know, 3 years in advance, and said, you know what? I'm going to buy two tables for this one. It's a local show. We could fill it up. And luckily, by the time we got to it, we were two table guys. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, we went to Saskatoon last year, and the tables were bigger.
8-foot tables.
They were 8-foot tables instead of 6-foot tables. So now we were no longer, it wasn't the equivalent of two tables. It was like 2.5 tables.
Right.
And we weren't 2.5 table guys, we found out.
Were you not, like, did you know about the size beforehand, or you just weren't prepared for it? Like, you didn't realize you had that much?
We didn't realize we had that much space. And then we had, you know, we'd brought everything we had for Calgary, so it was fine. But when we stretched everything out, some of it still felt a little redundant. Like, mm-hmm. We were almost wasting space.
So, dear listener, conventions are attention warfare. And what can happen is, if you have too big of a space, you've stretched out your display to the point where the concentration of interest is unclear to a person walking by.
Yeah.
And so they might glance at everything and look at everything, but now there's no like moment where they're needing to stop or they'll miss it. And if you can create a feeling where like you need to stop or you'll miss it,
yeah,
that's the beauty of it.
And we found layers by building in layers to the booth.
Yeah. Steps.
Not even just like steps in height, but also to layer things in front and behind each other.
Yeah.
You're slowing people down. But to go back to what you were saying about medium-sized shows and sort of when you're starting out, what shows are worthwhile going to, the rule of thumb that I've stuck to so far is, do I need to get on a plane to get there?
Yeah.
And if I need to get on a plane to get there, then it needs to be a big show like Toronto. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a show that I like. I don't feel like we could necessarily yet justify going to Ottawa or the Vancouver show. I've heard mixed reviews on, and it's because
it's gotten a lot better. This year was great. Last year was great. So
good. But you know, the cost of flying to and sleeping in Vancouver, not small, especially and to ship stuff over. So it needs to be. I need to have a little more faith in the show first before I'm willing to make that commitment, but we'll do Toronto every year, like you said, because it's giant. You don't really need to worry about it.
And for a first timer listening to the podcast who might be asking, dear listener, why are these How could it be possibly worth it to bring a few suitcases full of stuff all the way, you know, 1,000 kilometers across the country to because if you are controlling your means of production, then instead of making 10% per book like you get from a regular publisher, you make 90% or 80 if you factor in your costs. Suddenly there's a margin just on books that makes it worthwhile. And if you are producing artwork yourself in studio, the cost of reproducing that work is such a it increases exponentially over time. As, and this is coming back to semiotics, the more people see something, the more they think it's important, the more they think it's valuable. If you are going to shows regularly, they've seen you, they understand that you're going to come back, they understand, I hate the word brand, but they see the brand and they know the brand, and so they're like, okay, you'll be here next year. So if I get something and I'm unhappy, there'll be a time I see you again. And so that builds up over time. And the artwork also, the time invested and the money invested in producing it is stored in the artwork itself. If it's sold, it might take you
evergreen.
Yeah, it might take you all year to make 5 or 10 pieces, but the next year they're still available to you.
It's almost like I feel like it's an unfair advantage sometimes. And I'll go to a show where I'll feel like I don't have enough because I barely have anything new.
Like if you're beside a handmade ceramics booth.
Right. They have to make the
Every time I sell a poster that I know if I sell it, I can go home and
you made that poster 11 years ago during a lunch crunch.
Yeah.
And you're still making money off of it this weekend.
And it's not just money. It's still relevant to the, you know, it's the great democratization of art, which I've talked about before on the show. There's no gallery between you and the work, and you're not buying the original, so you can have it for $20. Yeah. So you can bring work to people who they love it, they admire it, they see something in it, they want to hang it on their wall, and it doesn't negatively affect their ability to pay either bills. They can just put it up. Yeah. And if they don't like it, it only costs them $20. Next year, they can take it down. Like, it's not a big... It's not like if they come to the studio here and want to spend $2,000 on a painting.
You will overthrow the kingdom of Thessaly. You will kill the king, Aristo, and wear his crown. You will do all these things without fear or wound because Zeus commands it.
I want to wheel it back just a second for what we were talking about, how you kind of grow into your booth and then it kind of naturally gets bigger as your work
as you make things.
There is nothing worse. What the booths that stick out in my mind are when people go and they get like 3 booths at the New York Comic Con and then show up with a portfolio and one single backstand and are taking up 30 feet of like premium real estate that like hundreds of artists got denied, but you got in, you took up this big space and you have nothing to fill it with. Don't do that. Don't be that person.
Well, and like I remember my first year when Steven and I were tabling, you know, we had one book and we had like 4 prints that were pulls of that book. And that was it.
Yeah.
And it was hard. It was really hard. Like those shows were net losses probably. When we
did you share the table?
The two of us?
Well, no, like did you share it with another company?
No,
like,
it was just us at one table. And you know, we only did 3 or 4 shows, all driving shows.
Yeah.
As we were learning how to go to shows and build tables and we were making other things and you know, we started to fill out that space. But I remember that first show, like going to Saskatoon, and we had one book and a couple prints, and we didn't understand that you need to be standing the whole time and like engaging people. And like it's really hard if you are just starting out and you don't have a sort of baseline amount of material that you can sell.
I usually recommend like attending a show or two before you get a table.
Oh yeah, don't listen to anyone telling you like, oh, your stuff is good enough. You should definitely get a table at this or that show. And then you show up and you don't know the culture of the show. You've got to go visit, you know, you got to visit and know how the crowd moves, who the constituent parts of those crowds. So where Justin and I had the advantage in that thing is we started more than a decade ago.
2008, yeah.
And shows grew up around us and we were going to them anyway. Mm-hmm. And so it's different. If you've never been to a room with 50,000 people who are going to be pushed through it, it'd be a good idea for you to go visit that room just as an attendee and see what's fun about it.
Bring a notebook. Ask questions. Like people behind the table, usually 9 out of 10, are really excited to talk about their craft, right? Like, how do you get into this?
Marshall, she'll tell you every secret.
So, okay, but if you two, like, on the spot, you're going to encourage someone to table one table at a show, and we'll say like a mid show. We'll say like a Saskatoon or a Winnipeg, or maybe not Toronto because that's even bigger. But in terms of number of say you're like
many
us,
qualifying questions before we can go on.
They're in books and art like we are. How many books do you think someone needs to have, or how many different art prints do you think they need to have enough variety to justify tabling?
Do you want to go first?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Whatever you have is enough. Mm-hmm. If you recognize that no one cares what you have, nobody is going to look past the cover of your book into it. No one sees the potential of the work from the outside. No one can become a fan of your work instantly. So you need to have a big enough display of the content of the work. And I'm mentoring a person who's going to be doing a one table thing, and they feel like they don't have enough work. And I said, take your 5 favorite pages, print them as 24 by 36 posters. You're probably not ready to design a booth yet for yourself. So take the stuff you like the best from the book and make a backstand display using easels that show off. And this is a person who works traditionally, so it'll be impressive. People will ask questions. Did you make that? Is that you? Did you do that by hand? And when they answer, yes, I did that all by hand, the question leads to the book that's on the table. That's all in here? Yeah, that's all in here. Now whatever you have is enough if you don't let the object speak for itself, because there's too many great objects at those shows. You need to present people with the question mark. So they look at it and they go, what is that? And you at the booth have the answer. That is this. Here you go. Because you don't want to be the guy. You know the guy, Justin. You want to buy my comic? Hey, here's my comic. Here's my comic.
Can I tell you about my comic?
Can I tell you about my comic?
I hate that that works sometimes.
It does work, but it's your soul will be eroded by doing it. And people will buy it out of guilt sometimes. And that's not good either. Better that they walk by and go, wow, what is that? And you're able to answer a question from a place of passion. And that's infectious. Even if they've never heard of you, they'll vote with their dollars now. I like that person. Their work is like complex and interesting. I may never see them again. The only way I can support them is to buy it right now because they're independent. That's great. That's better than Kickstarter. It's more authentic. I like
it. It's in person.
Because it's a person.
It's in person. Yeah. I usually tackle it like as if you were applying for a design or an illustration job. Your portfolio should be 15 to 20 pieces and varied, right? Have 15 to 20 pieces, be they posters or like comics, books, crafts, whatever. Do 15 to 20 things for sale and try a variety. Mm. Because that was a big part of my career trajectory is I was trying, I had traditional illustrations, I had paintings in Photoshop that I'm embarrassed by, I was trying this vector painting style, and I was having fun with it all.
Dear listener, Justin can do it all.
But I didn't know what people were going to go for. I didn't know what was going to like react. I didn't know what was going to sell. I didn't know what I wanted to do more of. I was just kind of figuring it out.
Those were in those wonderful, curious days.
Just experimenting.
Back when whimsy was allowed.
Back when whimsy was allowed. Yeah, where people were new to shows. They were new to you. And they would stop and say, like, what do you got? Mm-hmm. I think those days kind of eroded away as the attendees scaled up into the tens of thousands.
No, like, I think it comes back around again. I think there is a generation that has been doing, like, attending shows as long as we've been going there, and they know what they like, how it works, what they want.
That's a great point.
We're constantly, right, barraged by these new people who are like, how does this work? So you're the artist, so this is art? Like, so I can, like, buy one of these? Like,
that's
you know?
That
conversation happens as much as, like,
that happened
hey,
in Brandon
I've,
a lot for me, yeah.
I've seen you for 7 years. What's new?
Yeah. They're just grizzled, right? I know you got something to sell me.
I don't even know if they want it anymore. It's just tradition, right? Like, we buy from you every year. It's like, So
so do you like it or not like it?
Are you saying that fans of Chasing Artwork are just institutionalized now, and that is why they show
They're
up?
They're very supportive, and I love them to death.
Yes. Love them to
sometimes death. I wonder, do you want this, or is this just like...
Do you like the art, tradition? Or do you just like me? Mm. Do you like me for me? That's oh, cool it's so me. Cheap.
Yeah.
It's you for you sometimes. Mm-hmm. Remember that one reviewer, that YouTube reviewer that said that your booth had the handsomest people working at it or whatever? There was somebody that you made all the flutter.
Was that in San Diego? No, I have to assume it was in San Diego when the boxing guys were all there.
Yeah, it was probably.
I think this was Toronto with Tom and Taylor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So you were, you brought in the ringers.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah. That's how it is. That's okay. We have faces for radio. The thing I want to say about filling your space is you don't need an audience at all for the work that you've done to have had meaning. It is not about whether an audience shows up or whether people throw money at you or not, whether publishing deals happen or not. If you are working on a book, comic, magazine, poster, ceramic, Cthulhu, doesn't matter. If you are enjoying your time making it, it has already done everything it needs to do for you. It owes you nothing.
It doesn't have to become a side business
if
it's your hobby.
Yeah.
It can just be a hobby. That's okay.
Please throw away the idea that every creative endeavor you have must therefore have a fiduciary expression to
right.
it. You do all kinds of drawings and paintings and watercolor things. The people don't see. I do collages and paintings and oil paintings. People don't see. Those aren't for you. Those are for me. You have those things too. And if something strikes you as, I want to share this with a broader audience, that doesn't have to do with money either. You can go to an art gallery, show your body of work, probably sell nothing, and still feel amazing. Having seen a room full of people respond to it.
What we were talking about before, like earlier in this, like maybe art gallery is where you need to go. Maybe craft sale is where you need to go. Maybe an anime show. Maybe a Comic-Con. There's
maybe the side of an abandoned building.
Maybe that's where it belongs. Yeah.
Right? Where thousands driving by can be lifted up. Not that I'm condoning public vandalism.
If you do enough of it, then your brand gets enough recognition that then you can start making merch and then you can be the next Banksy.
We're looking at you, Shepherd Fairy. We're
and here I thought he was referring to like a dumpster on the side of an abandoned building and that's where it all belongs.
Oh, no. No, not at all. Although I do know people that has been the destination of some of their work because they believed they had to turn it into a product before they figured out why they were making it in the first place.
And we found, like, in our careers, the more we try to make it something sellable, the more we try to, like, appease the masses, the less it works.
Yeah, it doesn't work at all for me.
Yeah.
If I try to imagine what a city wants from me, I'm wrong every single time. I've found, and this is why, if I bring a broader collection of work where I love every piece in it, I can do fine. Because when people ask about it, I'm genuinely excited and enthusiastic about telling the story of it. And that can bridge the gap between, you know, whether they want to put it on their wall or not. Oh, I met that guy. He doesn't seem as creepy as his work suggests. Right? Those are important things. So please, dear listener, avoid hustle culture if you can.
Listen to your muse.
Yes, to your muse. Harness hustle culture when is appropriate, but not everything has to be.
We got to come up with a new term. I think, hustle culture just sounds
outdated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's sick. It's just, it's just a dying branch of late stage capitalism. It's okay.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's fine. We'll find a new thing.
Rise up, you dead, slain of the Hydra. Rise from your graves and avenge us. Those who steal the golden fleece must die.
Speaking of new things, this is the beginning of convention season.
We're in it now, yeah.
It's
I got another month.
Yeah. It's coming. And now we'll put the spotlight on Lyndon.
Oh no. Oh no.
Lyndon, remember you used to be a one table guy?
That was, yes.
You used to be a one book guy.
Yep.
something has changed considerably in this new convention year. You're going to have a stack of finished graphic novels as a person who is gone from having one graphic novel and a couple of, like you said, pull images from that graphic novel available, to someone who has been whisked off to a French festival to celebrate the launch of one book, has self-produced another book, has kickstarted a book. You're going to have a stack of stuff. How does that make you feel? Are you nervous?
No, I'm excited about it. The only thing I'm nervous about is trying to get everything prepared in time, because it feels like this year we have there's a whole bunch of new stuff. You know, we have new three new books coming this year. There's a handful of new art prints to show. There's some we got at the end of last convention season. We bought three new book stands that we get to use for our display. And there's a whole bunch of things that I want to test out. We're trying pins. We're trying a pin that we're going to have.
Enamel pins.
Enamel pins.
They're on their way.
Yeah, yep. I have some new ones too, yeah.
So there's just, it feels like you guys have said, as the convention seasons go by over the years, you have to recognize when to adapt and what to experiment with and not get stuck with the same display year over year and to always have new things. And that's, I think that's exciting.
Let's call it the French experiment. You were at Angoulême.
Yeah, I was.
Say it properly.
Angoulême.
There you go. You went there. Tell us about that experience and the difference between going to a literary comics festival as a member at large, essentially. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, properly, we should actually probably have Zach here also to talk about it on the show. So I'm going to keep my answers
to your side of the table?
Yeah, more relevant to me than to his, because I'm sure Zach and I's experiences are very different because he doesn't speak French.
So give the dear listener context. Who's Zach? What's the book? Why did you end up
in Zach, France? Zach Schuster and I have been working on a book called Hero Man that's being published later this year, the year of our Lord, 2024.
Who's maybe your Lord?
Comics Lord 2024, called Hero Man. It's being published with At Bay Press, and part of the perks of having that book with At Bay is that the publisher is very involved in international book festivals. We're not talking about comics festivals. We're talking literary book festivals. Mm-hmm. And
not fan festivals in this case.
Right, yeah. Yes. And so Angoulême is the international comics festival that happens every year in France. It is the largest graphics novel festival in Europe. And this past year, the festival had designated Canada as the country of distinction, quote unquote. And so there was a delegation of 60 people that were 60 Canadian creatives that were invited to the festival.
They were distinctive.
I would be surprised if half actually ended up attending.
Right.
And what that involved was Zach and I, as part of this delegation, flew out to France for that festival.
Let me just underline for a moment, one of the intangibles of having a book out from a publisher is you can be invited to an international book festival as a, you know, representation of your government. That's weird and awesome.
Yeah. So Canada, so what's really cool about Angoulême is that the festival spreads out sort of across the entire town. And so there are art exhibitions, there are, I don't want to say museums, dedicated to graphic novels, and, you know, most, if not all of the content there is French graphic novels.
Which are amazing graphic novels, by the way.
Yes.
The French are so good.
I'll say it badly, then you say it well. Bande dessinée.
Bande dessinée, yeah.
There you go.
So that was really cool, because you'd basically hop between these giant tents across town. You weren't sort of stuck in the same convention center all week. And, you know, Zach and I's tangible experience is that we split our time between the Canada Pavilion, where all of the Canada had its own sort of tent that had all of the Canadian content set up, and they did signings there. And then we spent the other half of our signings in the tent called Le Nouveau Monde, which is the New World, which is for independent publishers only, so none of the major publishers are in
that
tent. So
At Bay Press was in that one?
At Bay Press was part of the Canada booth.
Okay.
And
okay.
The Canada booth was located in the translation title, The New World tent.
Gotcha.
The other one, the other main tent was called Le Monde du Bull, which is basically the Bull Worlds, which is the big publishers, so the major French publishers. And
the Bull World.
Right.
Okay.
Someone else can translate that. I don't know if I've gotten it right anymore. Besides the point.
You've already proven yourself a French speaker of distinction compared to us. You're doing just fine.
But it was huge. Both tents were huge. The festival was packed. The biggest distinction that Zach and I very quickly learned in our first signing was that when you go to a signing, when you go to bring your graphic novel, you buy it and you bring it to get signed by the creative, it is not a 60-second sketch and onward. You took 10 minutes. Like the artist would take 10 minutes to draw an actual illustration in the cover of your book. And so it was a very, there was a very lengthy time period where you're standing, sort of connecting with the creative. That was very cool. The downside of it was that it was hard to get things signed. You know, some of the...
The lines would be long.
Some of the popular creatives that I wanted to get things signed from, they ran lotteries to get into the signing line because the creative could only do 5 of them an hour.
Right.
Jeez.
And so if they were only signing for 2 hours, they were only going to let 10 people get signings done.
And you know what's kind of amazing about that? I love the idea that they didn't speed up the artist. They limited the number of signings.
Yeah. And they didn't charge for any of it, right? Yeah. It's all free. Just as long as you bought the book.
Yeah.
So that was very cool.
It's a tangible thank you and a tangible exposure to the creative. I think that's so cool. Yeah.
And so the festival itself, amazing, would absolutely go back.
Might get invited back again if you keep it up.
Yeah. Well, the book wasn't out for this one. It'll be out for the next one.
That's right.
So in theory, hopefully I could just double dip on the same book and go back.
Perfect. Hand your homework in twice.
Exactly.
Even in international waters.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
But it was really funny in that, you know, Zach and I did signings together, and Zach doesn't speak any French. I can speak just enough French to like get by and convey.
You.
Yeah, well, to explain to people that I'm not very good at speaking French and we're all in on the joke. And so just like it was more pronounced than in English conventions because I was such an amateur with the language, but you really get into a rhythm of having the same conversations.
Oh,
right.
We know from doing conventions, you're having the same conversation 1,000 times a day.
Yeah.
But when it's in another language that you don't really know, it feels a lot. You're almost thankful for it because you're not having to think on your feet.
Yeah. You can learn the patter and then refine it in their language to be.
It's more almost comforting on that Sunday where you get that question and how long does a piece take you? And you don't have to like mentally think or power it at all. The words just come out and you can.
That's right. You can be thinking about other things.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can be composing an email to someone else in your head as you're explaining. Because it's a conditioned emotional response at that time. You know the answer, and you just say the answer. You don't have to spend any time thinking about it. My favorite questions are the ones that come out of nowhere, where I actually have to think about it at shows, you know? Like, where a person is either understands your influences enough to ask a very specific question, or they understand the work, or they are so confused by what the hell is in front of them because your work is weird outside of there that they ask a question you haven't heard, you know?
Yeah.
I love those moments.
And then, of course, the biggest thing that I really enjoyed was I don't know if enjoy is the right word, but, you know, there was a very strong distinction between sort of artsy bande dessinée and Western sort of big two comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this discussion with another creative at the festival where if you were a Western comics maker and one of your works was translated so that it could sell in France or across Europe, if you wanted to try and make sure that that book in the comic book store, in the bande dessinée shop, was not placed with the Western comics, that you don't want to be near the Marvel or the DC because that was sort of a neglected part of the comic book store.
Well, one thing that you're,
in comparison.
Yeah, one thing that you're... And in my misspent youth, of course, I owned a comic store, and so we would import European comics. Hardcover, bande dessinée, we would import French ones that we couldn't read ourselves. and nobody in the shop could read, but game knows game, as the expression goes, right?
Right.
People knew they were of quality, and even if they could not read them, it was worth having them because they were just of a... But what I came to realize is these different works have singular voices. And the difference between comics by committee, which is Marvel in DC, and comics in France and Europe is the difference of voice. The creator is allowed to have their voice, their idea, their vision, and the publisher supports it for good or ill, and sometimes it goes well for them and sometimes it doesn't. But if you're buying a person's book, you're not buying Batman, you're buying the work of the creator, and whatever they're making up is what you're chasing, which is what I prefer, you know, as a consumer myself.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If I know that a committee decided which character needs to be included in that issue, I wonder at its validity as a story that needs to be told. And so when a good Western comic stands out on the rack from a big two, it's in spite of all of those limitations. And that's why I think we celebrate them so highly when that works.
You've escaped the committee.
Yeah.
When you feel the touch of the marketing council, the marketing committee on movies, shows, comics, like it,
yeah.
I don't know about you guys, but it immediately...
Yeah.
Madam Web.
Right, yeah. I haven't seen it. I can't say
anything. Exactly.
Can't speak.
That's why. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. More and more in like TV shows and comics and stuff. Like, it's just like there was a lot of people that were not creative involved on this that were pulling the strings, and it's noticeable. And I don't like it.
Yeah. So, if you find yourself reading a big two comic and a tear rolls down your cheek, or you're really excited to turn the page, please, please, dear listener, look at the credits, write down the name of the creative team. If they're that good to make you feel something, I promise you they have work that is of a singular voice. They've probably got something at Image. They've probably got something at a European publisher. You could probably find their voice more purely out in the world if you hunt creators and not characters. Well, I think that about wraps it up for this episode of Super Pulp Science, where we have talked about how genre gets made. I am GMB Kamichuk, encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.